Welcome to this Politics Guys listener mail slash comment slash things that we're screwing up show. I guess we haven't done one in a while, but I'm looking forward to it. I always enjoy these shows.
We haven't screwed up much in a while.
No, you know, so. We really haven't, I think. So that's good. So you ready to get right at it, Jay?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it. Our first piece of mail, I guess, is from, Sam, who writes, "Can I get your take on the spending America does on healthcare relative to countries that have a single-payer system?" And he mentions a number of countries, America, the United States, Australia, Canada, Japan, and the UK. And he also, Sam, helpfully includes what these countries spend per capita, private, public, and total. And, of course, the United States is considerably higher. In fact, almost double the number two, which is Australia and Canada. And his question is, given that there are similar, if not improved, quality of outcomes in countries like Australia, Canada, Japan, and the UK compared to the US, even though they spend drastically less per capita, there must be something dramatically wrong with our system, right? And Sam would like to get our comments on that. So what do you think? Is there something dramatically wrong with our system? Is that a reasonable conclusion to draw from that, Jay?
It's one conclusion to draw, and it's not an unreasonable conclusion, but I think there may be other things at play. But you go ahead first, because I think you're probably going to say that it is a completely reasonable conclusion and the only conclusion we can.
Well, I don't know if it's the only conclusion, but I think it certainly is eye-opening. And I think that if you look at health systems around the world, and if you just look at, in fact, countries that are like us, more or less, I mean, we're talking about wealthy, industrialized countries, sure, that sort of thing. And that, I think, is the fair comparison. You know, it doesn't really matter what our system's like compared to that of, I don't know, Togo or something like that, right? That's not a good comparison, I don't think. But if you look at that, our system is unique. And that has to do with a lot of weird historical kind of quirks and so forth. But nobody does it like we do it. And that's one just indisputable fact. The second indisputable fact is we pay an awful lot more for healthcare than any other rich advanced country does, an awful lot more. And right, the third thing that I would say is fairly indisputable is that health outcomes, just generally speaking, this is overall, you know, your results may vary. Health outcomes tend to be roughly similar. If not, you could argue somewhat better in other countries. Now, that one's a little more arguable, some might say, because we have this huge country with all sorts of different types of people in the population.
And so,
but still, even when you do things that control for some of that, there aren't huge divergences in outcomes. So it seems to me that the things we can say, we do it differently from everyone else, we spend a lot more, and it's hard to say that our outcomes are so much better or a whole lot different given what we spend. So to me, that leads inevitably to the conclusion that our system is wildly inefficient. Now, I think to that point, you and I probably are in complete agreement, right?
I don't know a complete agreement, but okay. I'd say I certainly see our system as inefficient, and there are issues with that. I think we'd probably disagree to the extent on, you know, wildly inefficient and so forth, and to the remedy of what could be done to bring more efficiency.
Yeah.
But I think in principle, yeah.
I think where we differ then is in terms of what we do about this to make the system more efficient, basically. Because, you know, this is a system, the American healthcare system, that works great for some people. If you are in, say, the top 20% of the socioeconomic distribution in this country, this system probably works great for you. You probably can get in to see a doctor right away, more or less. You probably get good care. You probably have a lot of choice. And this is a system that works really well for you. But, and just like so much in this country, I'd argue, there's this bifurcation between the top 20 or so percent. And I just recently found out that this is shocking to me that my household is in the top 20%. I never really considered that,
I've always considered you a top 20%.
Thank you. But, you know, this kind of gets into something broader. I've been talking about, there's this great book that came out not too long ago called Dream Hoarders by a guy named Richard Reeves. It's a fascinating book, arguing that the problem isn't the 1%. The problem is the 20%. And so by making it the 1%, a lot of these people who are doing really well, like me, I guess, can just blame somebody else and say, well, I don't need to change anything. You don't need to do anything about my benefits and my advantages. It's these people like, well, like Donald Trump or the rich people, that kind of thing.
You always want to notch it up like 1% above where you are. It's the top 15% who are the problem. It's not you.
Exactly. So I think it's kind of an interesting argument, but I think there's a lot to it. And I think it applies definitely to the healthcare system. And, you know, given how our system of government in general is set up, that top 20%, these are the people that have all the political pull for the most part. And so it makes sense that we have a system that works really well for those people because they're the ones who influence the political system. But it's that bottom 80% that has the system that's really problematic, which is what I think is so frustrating and makes it so difficult to kind of make any sort of changes. Now, so that's where I'm coming from with that. What about you, Jay?
You know, actually, I think you're right on a lot of those things. I was going to say that, again, we've got sort of a disparate healthcare system in that we have some people who are, as you said, absolutely the healthcare system is great and the best. So there was something recently I read, and I don't even remember where, but just sort of a view of how we're sort of diverging in terms of like the people who are fit are becoming more and more fit, and the people who are not are becoming more and more unfit. It's sort of we have like, you know, more marathon runners and like more really obese people. Just sort of this
that also tends to break down on socioeconomic type of grounds. Absolutely. Very much so.
And that was going to be my next thing is I think some of these other countries that we're looking at are sort of more homogenous, not just ethnically, racially, all that, but economically and culturally. I would say that that's certainly the case in when, you know, we compare to, you know, Scandinavia and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe less so in Canada. Canada's probably the closest to us. Australia, I couldn't really tell you for sure, but my sense is in most cases, we're dealing with smaller populations, more homogenous populations. And you're dealing with, I'm going to bring up my man, Edmund Burke, just because I always do. You know, in some ways, these things are, it's not a government thing, it's cultural, right? I mean, I think that's just something that, I don't know whether people know, I serve on a board of a nonprofit that provides free and charitable medical care. And the struggles we face there is it's not a matter of even providing the care. It's getting the people to come in. It's getting the people to see they have a problem. It's getting the people to say, hey, I've got to keep taking my medication, even when that medication is being provided for them for free. Right. I mean, there are these barriers which are not it's not a money issue. It's a cultural and education issue. And I think we have more of that, those sort of things to get through than maybe these other countries do. The other thing which I don't know in terms of the numbers that we're talking about, when we talk about who spends the most, is whether that includes prescription drugs. On when we're talking about healthcare, my guess is it probably does, and to a certain extent, there's maybe some you know, the U.S. subsidizing the rest of the world in terms of U.S. payers really paying for the, you know, maybe the lion's share of the research and so forth that goes into creating these drugs, which can be significant, and that's not necessarily reflected in prices paid by folks in other countries. And again, I'm not sure, because I'm not sure what the numbers you're looking at are, and that can vary. But
yeah, a couple points on the prescription drug thing. Two things that sort of irk me, I guess you could say, about that is, number one, that there have been calls to allow Medicare to bargain with.
Here we go again with that. Well, but yes, go ahead.
to bargain with drug manufacturers to help lower costs, and those have been pushed down because apparently in that case, Republicans don't like competition and bargaining power and so forth. I know you disagree with me on that. But secondly, if you take a look at profit margins for some of these, for these pharmaceutical companies, they are doing very well. So this idea that all this is necessary for R&D is just simply not supported by the facts as far as I can tell. But
well, I'm not arguing whether or not their profits should be or shouldn't be higher. I'm just saying Americans are footing that
sure,
bill.
Sure, yeah, and I think not. And, you know, to your larger point, I certainly agree. And in fact, isn't this a lot of what Charles Murray gets into in his book Coming Apart, right?
Exactly what Charles Murray gets into.
Yeah, and so, and I think you're right that we face unique challenges in that, and that's the problem. Even if we agree on the fact that because of a lot of factors, including cultural factors, it's much harder for the United States to have those sort of systems that aren't a system that's not bifurcated there. In terms of fixing that, how do you increase the quality and the accessibility and the availability to that lower 80% without taking any away from that top 20% that's going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that doesn't happen? And that's a hugely difficult political problem, especially given... Go ahead.
I differ from you in that I don't think it's a zero-sum game like that. I don't think it's a matter of splitting up the pie and you know, the healthier people are healthier just because of money. Again, I get that goes to more my, it's more education and attitudes and so forth. Is money a part of it? Yeah. Are things like access to healthy food a part of it? Yeah. Are environmental things about where you live and can you get transportation to where you, yeah, all that. Absolutely. But those typically aren't the huge money driver problems that we talk about when we think about healthcare. And I think those are things that are subject that they could be, you know, more community-based solutions of let's work out, you know, what can we do to encourage people to eat more healthy, to exercise more, and all those sorts of things to stay on their meds. And I think there are probably some low dough ways to do that. But
yeah, I would like that to be true, but then this is, you know, most of the time I'm this kind of center left sort of guy. But here's where when I start thinking about this problem, I think that fundamentally the problem is a problem of late 20th, early 21st century American capitalism run amok, basically. And that's a whole nother conversation, obviously. And I would love to there's a part of me kind of, I wouldn't say my inner socialist, but my inner kind of social democrat, I think you could say, on some of these issues. That one day will be unleashed in some of these conversations. And I think that's why this is so fundamentally difficult. I see these problems as so intertwined with the sort of system of the variant of capitalism that we have set up in this country that forces these people into these subsistence wage jobs without good health care, without access to it and so forth. And I just see it as this hugely just tragic systemic sort of problem that I don't think is going to be dealt with as long as we have the current system of capitalism that we have. And God, that's got to scare the hell out of you, Jay. I'm sure that kind of talk.
No, well, I, you know, I would just counter with that again. In my role that I see in doing some of this nonprofit stuff that I do, you know, again, one of the problems that so often that we face, and the organization that I work with, despite the Obama guarantee of everyone will be insured and no more uninsured, 40% of the people who come through the clinic I'm associated with are uninsured. The numbers that we see also in terms of Medicaid signups, that's another thing that, look, Medicaid is there. Lots of times people don't want to sign up for it because they don't want it. They're kind of living off the grid. There's help there. And you can say Medicaid's great or not great and should be funded or better funded. And that's a separate argument. But to say there's no access there. And the other thing that we see a lot are people qualify for Medicaid 1 month, and then they don't, and then they do again, and then they don't. And it's because of, you know, again, the nature of the program, the nature of how they work or don't work that, you know, sure, they keep coming on and off. So it's again, this is not just a Congress needs to write a bigger check type situation to me. It's a matter of is there a way to spend this money smarter?
Right.
So,
and you know, I shouldn't.
And again, dealing with what you know are people's proclivities of folks who, well, they're on Medicaid, well, you know, they forget to renew what they're supposed to do. They forget to turn in their stuff because some people are just more on the ball than others.
Sure.
And that is one of those things that you really, it's hard to say in America, but I'll say it. So. Yeah.
And I should point out that I don't disagree with your, you know, cultural factor analysis. I think conservatives tend to put too much weight on that. And maybe some on the left, you can argue, put too little weight on that. And I would accept that. But I think for so many of these problems, there's nothing that a good single payer system wouldn't solve. But we'll leave it at that. Certainly, that's not your preferred solution. All right. Moving on, we have, let's see here, Tristan, who writes, "Hey guys, a longtime listener and Patreon supporter." Thank you, Tristan. We appreciate that. He says, "Jay has a running theme when it comes to protests that goes like this. Of course, everyone's allowed to protest, but let's be honest. It's basically just a feel good, let's wave around signs, fun time thing." I kind of like that summary.
That's a good paraphrase. Yes.
Tristan writes, Floyd says, "As a counter, I'll offer this. I drove to D.C. to protest in the Women's March and did, as did many people in my rural, very red county in Virginia. It was a thrilling event. Afterwards, I and a record number of other Democrats inspired by the march ran for the House of Delegates in Virginia's 2017 election. Together, we flipped 15 seats, shrinking the Republican control of the Virginia House from 66 to 34 to 51-49. You might recall the majority deciding seat was so close it was won by coin toss. I personally raised $30,000 in my deep red district, a district that hadn't even had a Democrat run in the last election cycle. Large groups of protesters formed resistance groups that raise money for candidates and do political action. After I lost, I and the guy who ran the district next to me ran and won the chair and vice chair position in our county Democratic committee. That committee's membership has grown 300% since Trump took office. I guess my point is, yes, protesting is fun, but the people who protest aren't stopping after they leave their signs on the White House lawn." So Jay, any, obviously that was somewhat, you know, directed to you.
Sure.
I'll say
kudos to you, Tristan. I mean, really, that's an inspiration. And sometime down the road, I think we'll have another show about some of those things about why I find that your story is inspiring. But I think you're right in terms of a lot of these movements serve as a good way to bring people in and get people involved. Longer term, the point I make is that often they don't serve any short term goal and seem to be sort of misdirected, and are in it for fun. Now you again ran and did well and got involved. Would you have gotten involved or not gotten involved if you hadn't gone to that Women's March? I don't know. But I'll stick to my guns on saying the direct policy impact that you see following these sort of events tends to be minimal. But I would agree with you. I wouldn't discount the value of the connective purpose that they serve. And you go to these things and everybody signs up for stuff and everybody gets on the mailing lists. And that's something that can bear fruit down the road. So.
Sure. And I guess, you know, even if say 90% of the people who get on the mailing list don't ever really follow up or do anything, that 10%, that's, maybe half of that 10% wouldn't have done it otherwise. And so that's what I think you meant about the direct versus indirect effects.
Right? And I guess, the other thing that I would point out with some of these marches is that, it's often the comparison that's often drawn is either civil rights marching or the Vietnam protest. And to me, that's always just struck me as again, sort of false, because, again, civil rights marchers were out there literally risking their lives or risking pretty severe consequences for what they were doing. And I think it's sometimes folks on the right just get this sort of I don't know what you want to call it. This sense to eye roll, and I'm not directing this at Tristan, But for the folks who talk about, you know, how brave they are and standing up and doing this. And it's sort of, again, it's like getting up at the Oscars and making the speech that, you know, everyone's going to cheer for in front of your own people. But look, I mean, Tristan, if you're running in a completely red district and you're not getting those accolades, you know, again, that's something different, but to me, that's the sort of thing that sort of irks me and a lot of conservatives is the sort of the virtue signaling is, hey, I'm doing this and this shows that I'm good. And lots of times it doesn't have any particular policy goal attached to it other than.
I should point out that, you know, and of course, this is something that happens on the right, too. We see with the Tea Party movement, for instance, that's starting, you know, most of the people involved in that, you can make the same claims, but There were a small number of people who actually
it was the organizational piece of it,
took that further. And so virtue signaling is certainly not something that is exclusive to the left, is what I wanted to point out there. But
Okay. I'll stop there.
Okay.
I won't stop there. Okay. I would say, though, again, with the Tea Party, there was something more of a specific agenda. You know, again, there was the, you know, the whole taxed enough already. Idea that there was here's what we're running from, here's what we're running for. So I think it's a little bit different. And also I just in generally, people on the right, we're just not big marchers.
No, not nearly as much. Yeah, that's true. True.
Again, it's just not in our DNA.
Well, and I would argue it's not so much it not being in your DNA, but largely being because you have much more control over. No, you have much more control over the corridors of power and so forth. So you don't have to take to the streets. You can just kind of have your lobbyists kind of go behind the scenes, and that is an option. It's not open.
And again,
many.
I take the absolute opposite thing of gosh, I'd love to go to DC and march around and protest stuff, and then check out a few museums, but got to work. So,
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I will leave it at there. How about that? Okay. How about that? All right. Tommy writes, "Dear Mike and Jay, I'm a big fan of the podcast. I like the amicable, rational discussions that you have. Keep up the great work."
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks to Tommy. We do appreciate hearing that. I'm a college student, he writes, and one of my classes is about the history of GM. Naturally, labor relations are a big component of the class. GM struggled with many things, including poor market responses, an overextended dealer network, and burdensome labor contracts. All of these factors led to GM's bankruptcy, but the contracts that GM had with the UAW, it's United Auto Workers, were particularly egregious. For example, GM had a jobs bank where employees that would have otherwise been laid off could go to receive training or perform non-traditional tasks while receiving full pay. And apparently this is part of the agreement with the UAW. Another example is the fact that at the time of the bankruptcy, there were 4.6 retired employees for each active member of GM. I'm studying finance, and I tend to lean toward the libertarian end of the political spectrum, so I don't come into the class with a positive view of unions, and this class has reinforced some of my beliefs. It seems to me that declining union membership and power is a good thing. Unions hinder a company's ability to respond to changing market conditions. Additionally, cheaper labor benefits consumers with lower prices. I was wondering what you guys think about the decline in union membership in the United States, and if you think it's a good thing that will benefit consumers, or that if you think that the harm to workers poses a greater threat. All right, well, Jay, I'll let you start off with this one.
Wow, I like this guy.
I bet you do.
No, I think those are all excellent points, and this is I'll put this out as I am someone who grew up in a heavily union town. I'm still living sort of a heavily union town, where we had the primary employer was a GM plant. That plant has recently laid off another shift of folks because of poor sales, and so. I think that's exactly right. You know, if you look at some of these, the way these contracts and some of the pieces written into them, there is no way to compete. And the pieces that, you know, when GM went through the bankruptcy, a lot of people were saying this is, again, this is not a car company. This is an insurance company that does a little bit of a sideline in cars. And there is just no way to really compete, even if you put out the best product and sell the most, when you have those other tremendous burdens that were, again, put in years and years ago, thinking that we'd never have to pay for them. So I think he's absolutely right on that. On the other subject of just unions, you know, generally, is something that I would remark. And again, I grew up in a town, and Mike, so did you, where everybody knew somebody, had a dad, a grandfather, an uncle, or someone like that who worked in a steel mill or worked in heavy industry or something like that. And those, and I can't impress enough that those kind of jobs, I mean, folks who work in steel mills and coal mines, those are dirty, dangerous jobs. That it's terrible hard work under really tough conditions. And historically, you had a lot of people coming into those jobs who had little or no education. Again, in the situations that Mike and I, both of you grew up in, there were plenty of people the generation before us who were immigrants who, you know, maybe didn't speak English or didn't speak it well, lacked even a high school education. And this is the only thing they could do. And they were in a really, there was a tremendous imbalance in the power between the average worker and these places and these horribly dangerous jobs. And to me, I can look back and I can say, yeah, those folks need a union to protect themselves and to have a you know, fair safety and so forth. Now, again, a lot of times when these happened, we didn't have a lot of the OSHA stuff, the safety stuff that became that came around in large part because of union activism. But these days, the jobs are different, both in terms of those industrial jobs at like a GM. It's not as dirty and dangerous as it once was. It is more highly, you know, highly technical. Likewise, when you have issues like, you know, public unions and Mike, I don't know, are your folks at NKU unionized?
Kentucky does not allow public employees unionize. Right. No, yeah. So, which is one of the reasons why we've had almost no raises in the last decade, essentially. I'm not even kidding. So, yeah, I have some strong thoughts on that, but that's
But again, let me put it this way. The idea to that, you know, again, folks who work in a white collar office setting would face the same kinds of issues that folks who are working in the coal mines and therefore need a union. Again, that's something that I think just raises costs on everyone, and folks can do better bargaining for themselves. So anyway, that's my really quick bit on unions. But
well, Jay, I'm glad to hear, and not surprised, because you're a fair-minded guy. I'm not surprised to hear that you acknowledge the importance of unions in the past and all the good things that they have done, you know. And I think that's something that some conservatives who aren't nearly as fair-minded or thoughtful as you aren't willing to do. And so kudos to you for that. Where we part ways somewhat is
but I'd say it's been about downhill since about 1965 or so.
Yeah, no, I would certainly say that the world has changed, and that the relationship between unions were in a stronger position regarding management before we had a globalized economy. You know, when the United States was basically the only game in town.
Union has also had a stronger hand before, when manpower was more important, when we didn't have the type of automation that we have now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, I think that unions are still vitally important for redressing or helping to rebalance the inherent power imbalance between labor and capital. And I think that's there's a hugely important role for that. But of course, given the fact that there are more options and things, and companies can move overseas and so forth, unions don't have the same sort of power. And that makes sense. The world's changing. Both business owners and labor have to recognize that. And I think you can make a reasonable case that union leadership took too long to recognize that, just like American business owners took too long to recognize the threat to globalization in many cases, which makes sense. The world changes, and it's hard for us to adapt to that sort of thing. But I think that unions are important for a number of reasons, not just in terms of helping workers in that particular area. And they're certainly hugely important there in terms of salary, in terms of benefits, in terms of still safety concerns and other things like that. Absolutely. but they're also important in terms of being really one of the only groups that consistently has lobbied on behalf of, more generally, the political interests of, well, I'll call them the lower 80%, whatever, the middle class and lower middle class and so forth. And what we've seen, as union membership has declined, that lobbying power has declined, and there's been much less of a counterbalance to business influence in Washington. And that's bad, I think, for a number of reasons. And I think people both on the left and the right should be concerned. You can understand why people on the left would be concerned, of course, but also on the right, due to these very real concerns with crony capitalism. A lot of things what business interests do is they're not looking for a rich and vibrant competitive business environment. They're looking to carve out special little anti-competitive things for them. And the less pushback they get from that, the more they're able to do that. And that's something that both, I think, the left and the right can agree is not good for anyone. So that's kind of my take on that.
I disagree that it follows that stronger unions mean less crony capitalism. To me, I think that's I'd argue that differently. In fact, I would say in some cases, unions could be the beneficiaries of crony capitalism, and the example I'd point to would be GM. But that's you know, that's an argument for another day. So
okay. All right, next we have Peg, right? Hello, gentlemen. First, thank you again for your incredible work, candor, while discussing difficult topics and voices of reason in these challenging days. I've been wondering, what publications do you think give a credible and accurate look at the Clintons' financial crimes, sellouts, and shenanigans? I love that word, shenanigans. We don't hear that word enough, you know? Thank you, Peg. While we're getting closer to some weighty revelations about Trump, I wonder more and more, what is the real story on Crooked Hillary? I know there's the book Clinton Cash. Would you put that book in the credible and accurate category? And can you recommend any other books and articles?
Wow, I like her too.
Yeah, well, you know, I did.
This is a good week.
I did a little research, and so I should point out, Clinton Cash is written by a Breitbart senior news editor. Take that for what it's worth. I take that to mean I would not put that necessarily in the credible and accurate category, more kind of a partisan hit job sort of thing. That said, I think there are a couple of reasonably even-handed books that deal with Clinton-related issues and that I have no problem recommending. First is a book called An Affair of State. This was written back in 2000 by Richard Posner, who's one of my favorite public intellectuals. He's a federal judge. I think he's one of the people who would have made the Supreme Court a much better Supreme Court had he ever been nominated. One of the most cited, if not the most cited, legal scholars in the late 20th, early 21st century. A brilliant man, actually more a person of the right than the left, but totally fair-minded. And this really focuses.
He writes like one book a week.
He's this insanely smart person. Yeah. Yeah, there are some people who, so many people, and I'll think, you know, that they're smart, but you know, I'm kind of in their league. And so he's one of these people you're like, wow, that's just like totally other level type of
stuff. An appellate, yes. I think he's just recently taken what's called senior status, which is sort of semi-retirement for it. He's an appellate judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah, brilliant guy. Almost everything he reads is worth reading, or writes is worth reading. And so if you want a thoughtful, fair-minded account of the whole Clinton investigation, impeachment, trial, all that sort of stuff, An Affair of State would be, I think, the place to go. Now, to more in terms of the shenanigans type thing, there's a book called Bloodsport by James Stewart. And this was back.
That's what I was going to recommend. You stole mine.
There you go. Now, he's an attorney, a journalist. He also won a Pulitzer Prize for something, not that, but something else. But
Den of Thieves?
Was it Den of Thieves? I don't know.
Den of Thieves also by, and it's not about Clinton, but that's about Wall Street. But that's also a fantastic book by Stewart. So
yeah, and I think the general rule on this sort of thing is what I always do, and I always tell students in my classes when we're using real books, I try to use real books in my classes because they're a lot less boring than textbooks, is the first thing we do is we say, what do we know about the author? And so if you want to know if something is a credible work, that would be where I'd go first. And if somebody is coming from a very partisan kind of background and not like sort of what I call a serious background, well, then it's not to say that people from kind of partisan, unserious backgrounds can't write serious books. People change and do things, but I tend to take those things with a big grain of salt. So that would be my first recommendation, just more in general about that. And I imagine you'd agree with that, Jay.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think of what other recommendations I could give.
That's tough. I mean, it's a tough one off the top of your head, I would imagine, yeah. Sort of thing. I had a little bit of time to do that. So, yeah, I didn't come up with these books just off the top of my head. I looked through a lot of stuff, most of which was absolute trash, but I wanted to give people at least a few specific recommendations who are interested in that sort of thing. But so there we go. All right, let's see here. We have next Seth, who commented on the website, politicsguide.com, on my view of President Trump's authority to launch Syria strikes. He wrote, "Mike, I wanted to drop you a note about the discussion you had with Jay in reference to the legality of President Trump's recent strike on Syria. I agree with you that Congress has abrogated their responsibility to act as a check and balance on the power of the executive to make war. Where I disagree is in your belief that the president must receive authorization before using force. Indeed, the power to declare war was reserved for Congress. The practical check on the power of the executive to wage war was that only Congress could authorize a military, and I believe only for 2 years, pending a congressional renewal. However, once that military is authorized, the Constitution is clear. The executive is commander-in-chief. This was addressed at some level by the War Powers Resolution, but even that gives the president 60 days to make war before seeking congressional approval. Simply, the standing military, which was one of the founders' real fears, is all the authorization the president needs to command troops and send them into combat. After having read many dissenting opinions to mine and hearing yours, and considering the differences in the need for a military force in 1789 and today, I honestly wonder if an amendment may not be necessary to return the nation to the founders' intent. Minimally, a national discussion should be had about whether Congress should have the sole authority to authorize foreign military actions or whether that power ought to be exercised by the executive. This is not a simple topic, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts." Well, wow, that was that's the kind of great, thoughtful, very in-depth kind of question that it's great that we get those all the time from listeners. At least that's kind of my initial take on that. Now, my response is, I suppose, if you take a look at, you cite Seth, the War Powers Resolution, and which, became law over President Nixon's veto. While that does allow the president to engage troops in offensive operations for up to 60 days, it's not exactly entirely without congressional approval. There is a consultation stipulation in that where the president actually has to meet and talk to certain members of Congress within, I believe it's 48 hours or something like that. So there isn't a specific approval, but there's a consultation thing. And as far as we know, that wasn't met with regard to the Syria strikes. So I would argue that, and I should also point out that no president since the War Powers Act went into effect believes that the War Powers Act is constitutionally binding on them. They argue that it's unconstitutional. So there's that. But I guess I would argue that while it's true and right that the president has the ability to respond immediately in cases where the security of the United States is under immediate threat, like some kind of attack or something like that, in cases where that's not so, and that's most every case, certainly that's Syria, that there is a responsibility of the president to seek at least congressional consultation. And I would argue, under my differing interpretation of Congress's ability to declare war, to actually get some sort of congressional authorization, which the president did not do. And again, this is not a Trump thing. We can point to instances where President Obama did not do the same thing as well. So it's not like a partisan thing. Jay, what do you think?
Yeah, and I hope, I mean, and the last time we talked about this, I don't think I said that I didn't think Trump had authority to do what he did in Syria, because I think he does. But we also talked again on the hypothetical is ought he to have that authority, or ought he to have exercised it in that way? to me, this comes down to, and this is a little bit like we talked about on the Sunday show, are we making the legal case or are we making the political case?
Oh, good point.
You know, and if you want to say, well, so to me, a lot of these, you know, whoa, does the president have the power to do this? A lot of times the answer is, well, does he control Congress? Are they right. Who's going to object? You know, I don't think you would ever see a court step in and say, Mr. President, we believe your action in bombing this country is illegal and here forthwith order you to stop military activity. I think that would be a gross violation of powers and an infringement upon the executive branch, and I don't think that would ever happen. But what could happen, and the check and balance that is in the Constitution, is Congress is the organization that funds all of this. And you know, this has happened before, for example, in the 1980s, where Congress specifically disallowed funding of some of our adventures in Central America. Thankfully, we, you know, there was a way of work. There was a workaround, but you know, there was, but you know, there is that sort of authority where Congress can say, if they want to exercise that, and say, okay, look, you can say you want to do these strikes, but we're just not going to fund this or that, and that's, I think, the appropriate way to do
it.
That's
a pretty crummy check.
Rather than, pardon?
That's a pretty crummy check because it's so. After the fact, those kind of appropriations type of things. And also that, I mean, politically, that's not very feasible.
Let's put it this way. It doesn't have to be after the fact. I mean, that depends on the will of Congress and how quickly they want to act.
Well, right? I think that's the point, right? That given the fact that the president can just unilaterally act so much more quickly and Congress have to get together and do stuff and so forth. It certainly is an option legally. But from a practical standpoint, it's not much of a check, I would argue.
Well, let's put it this way. If there were the political will in Congress, and there isn't, in either party, for Congress to say, we hereby prohibit the expenditure of any funds for any bombing in Syria. If they had the numbers, they could pass that bill next week. But they don't. And that, again, that's the political check and balance. You saw that actually in back in the 60s in Vietnam, which is something that many, you know, conservatives still gripe about, in that, you know, Congress was sort of handcuffing the executive in terms of how it could conduct the war. So my point is, I think there are checks and balances beyond the War Powers Act that are sort of built into the Constitution. And I think this is just one of those. There's never going to be a hard and fast line, absent, you know, situations like a Pearl Harbor where everyone jumps up with acclamation and says, yes, let's declare war. And in many ways, maybe that's a good thing.
Well, I think we fundamentally agree on the main point here, at least the main practical point, is that from a political sort of standpoint, it's not like the situation is going to change anytime soon, no matter what kind of legal argument you might have either way on this. So, all right. In response to a call for listener questions I posted earlier this week on Facebook, actually, it was Noam responded with what was an amazingly comprehensive question. In fact, he put this on Facebook, and then he was thoughtful enough to provide what you call a broadcast-ready summary of his question for us to use on the air, which was really helpful. Thank you for that. So here's,
I think there was even a map.
This was a lot of effort, and we really appreciate it. It was a great question. Really more of an analysis than that was followed by a question I actually learned something from. So anyway, this is why our Facebook group is so great. If you haven't checked it out, there are some great people. It's not your standard kind of just ridiculous kind of snipes and so forth. I learn something from it every week, I think. So anyway, enough of that. So Noam writes, I want to voice some concerns and disagreements regarding your thoughts about Syria in episode 147. I want you to address where the U.S. responsibility in the Middle East comes from, why you think it can ever be successful, and what you think the nuances to U.S. presence in Syria particularly might be. Additionally, I'd like you to address what your view is of specific incidents over statistics and general trends in deciding foreign policy. Now, the first thing,
this is a final exam question.
Well, here. You know, this is like a whole episode type of thing. And I actually thought about if we were going to do a full episode, that might actually be a good special episode show. I don't know. What do you think about that, Jay? Should we answer that now, or maybe we should just hold off and maybe make that up? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think we should answer it to the extent we can now.
Okay. Okay.
Again, with the caveat that we are not international experts, we are not Syria experts. And, you know, the focus is you know, typically American politics on what we do here. But in I think the first part of the question is what gives us the authority, or why? How was it again?
The first part of the question is where the U.S. responsibility in the Middle East comes from.
I think there's a couple answers. One, we have, and you can argue rightly or wrongly, traditionally the U.S. has seen itself as a you know, the shining city on the hill, a global leader, has taken upon itself the role of world policeman and sort of to enforce stability throughout. The Middle East is particularly complicated, one, because it's got a lot of oil that a lot of people need. Two, it's strategically located between, you know, Asia and the Soviet Union and the West, and you know, was sort of a pivotal place, therefore, strategically. You know, in which, you know, these drugs, for example, the Soviet incursion in Afghanistan was you know, as a threat. Fourth, there are humanitarian issues, and Israel, I think, is a big issue there. It's important for us to have allies, and I think we have a moral cause and have had a moral cause to support a Jewish state in the Middle East. And more specifically to Syria, I think we've got a moral responsibility to the extent that, you know, President Obama had made the red line speech and so forth. And we sort of, you know, at one point sort of promised there would be repercussions, and there were not. And that empowered Assad and the Syrian civil war. So, yeah, briefly of the why are we responsible for this? I mean, that's. I guess that's my answer, and I could probably go on with a bunch of other factors, but those are the ones that come to mind.
Well, I think, you know, I agree in terms of the U.S. responsibility in the Middle East. I agree with everything that you said there. We would put maybe different emphasis on certain things, but I won't repeat that. I'll just say yes. I think you're absolutely right about that. There are a lot of things going on there. In terms of the one part, I guess I'll address is
you
why.
Part two.
What I say, well, why we think it can ever be successful. Now, I guess in terms of thinking about success, I think it's more a case of managing an inherently unstable situation. So I don't actually think that we're ever going to be successful in the Middle East. It's like we're going to solve the Middle East. It's an unsolvable geopolitical problem.
But what's the alternative?
Right, exactly. So we can make the Middle East, we can help to make the Middle East more or less stable in terms of what we do or don't do. And so that, I think, it's a success if it's not falling apart, basically, or hasn't fallen apart. And so, yeah, it's always going to be messy. I don't see that. It's been messy for forever, essentially, right? So that's
thousands
not,
of years.
Yeah, that's not going to change, basically. So I don't think we can be successful in that sense. In terms of the nuances in Syria, my God, people have written books. There are so many different actors involved, so many different countries. You know, you mentioned Israel, and then there's the Iran. There's Iran.
Yeah, in this case, we have essentially an Iranian Russian Assad alliance operating in Syria, and countered by. As sort of unspoken in this way, you know, U.S., West, Israel.
Yeah. And folks. And then there's our, you know, our alliances, our long-term alliance with Saudi Arabia, which also is very problematic in a lot of ways. And our alliance with Egypt, which is, I believe, still our second largest recipient of foreign aid after Israel. I mean, there are so many, and that's not even to mention the religious aspects right. of all of this. And so that's what makes it so difficult. It's all about nuance, clearly. And in terms of, you know, finally, what Noah mentions, specific incidents over general trends, from that, I think, I'm guessing what he's getting at is, do we respond to specific things that happen, or how does that play into our longer term goals and so forth? And that's another incredibly difficult question to answer. And I think, you know, we've seen administrations of both parties for generations now struggle with and fail to come up with good definitive answers to these questions. And I think it's not for a lack of will or smarts or trying. It's just because they're just inherently difficult to answer. So I think the problem, more than anything else, is people coming in and saying, well, we're going to fix this, because they're not going to fix this. The best we can hope with the entire situation, whether it's Syria or the Middle East in general, is to manage it.
You know, I'd take maybe a slightly more optimistic point. Again, maybe not fixing it, but a way to manage it. And if you look at the long-term goals of what our policy has in some way been, I think it's, one, partly it was based on Cold War containment, right? That's less of an issue now, but I would say not a non-issue. The second would be building partnerships, building peaceful relations between Israel and the other Arab states. And again, you can look back 40 years ago to Jimmy Carter and the Israel-Egypt Accord. You're now seeing a softening in Israeli-Saudi relations. And largely the other factor to look at is to look at the Muslim extremism that comes out of places like Iran and so forth, and deal with that. Now, the problem we've had so often is that the solution to these were sort of authoritarian military governments. You know, for example, in Egypt, Turkey comes to mind. I'm not sure whether you count Turkey in the Middle East or not, but it's in the mix. But you know, we've put in the uncomfortable situation of supporting regimes which are would be, to the American mind, really pretty crummy, just on the basis that, well, the alternative is probably worse. Those are, I think, the things we're trying, working long term, and those kind of things are going to take quite a while, particularly. But look, and this is going to be something that, I don't know if you read about Saudi Arabia recently had a, you know, showing of Black Panther.
That's right.
And which I, you know, first I didn't think, oh, that's cool. But that it was because there were no movies allowed in Saudi Arabia. And again, that's something that I didn't know, didn't think of, but it just gives you an idea of the contrast of cultures that we're talking about, and how far there is to go. That's going to be a long road, but
yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. All right. But to wrap things up, our final question for today, also in response to my Facebook call for questions, Joe wrote, I'm curious what it will take for Jay to personally be appalled at Trump. Where is his first red line? And then she flips it around. She says, on the flip side, what has Trump done that Mike likes? So I'll give you a little bit of a breather after you kind of wound up our last question. So there actually are a number of things that President Trump's done that I think are at least somewhat good. For instance, the corporate tax cuts, the higher standard deduction in the tax bill that he pushed for. I think you can make a good case for those to a certain extent. I agree, Jay, you and I have talked about that DACA is actually unconstitutional. I think it's a good policy, but I think how it was enacted was unconstitutional use of executive power. I agree that we need regulatory rollback in some areas, like, for instance, under Dodd-Frank. I think there should have been more carve-outs for smaller financial institutions, which it has been, you know, worked on in the Trump administration. I think he's right. He was right to respond more strongly to chemical attacks in Syria, though, again, I think congressional authorization would have been the way to go with that. I think it's possible that his approach to Korea might actually yield some really positive results. Well, you know, it's still early days, though I also wonder if sanctions might not have happened, those kind of tough sanctions, if Kim did all those tests, regardless of who was president, whether it be Hillary Clinton, John Kasich, or whoever, that kind of thing. So I think there are a number of things where I say, yeah, okay, these are things that are not only unobjectionable, but I think that you can make a good case, have moved the country, at least in part, into a positive direction. So those are Trump administration things, though I tend to associate them probably more with just some traditional Republican things that I have a certain amount of sympathy for. So sure. I'm not all, just because Trump does it, I think it's evil. So yeah. That's my part of the question.
You know, as far as what would I be appalled by Trump doing? Again, I guess I'll take this, you know, first on the political level and on the personal level. On the personal level, I'm appalled by Trump all the time. And I have been for quite some time, and I try to make that clear. For example, looking back before the Southern Super Tuesday primaries, his statements, you know, regarding he didn't know who David Duke was, and you know, not denouncing that endorsement as quickly as he did, and to me, that's I personally, I don't know that Trump's a racist, but I think it's fair to say he made common cause with racists for his advantage back then. So yeah, I thought that was appalling. Trump's statements about women, I think those are appalling. You know, I think I've made the you know, argument a number of times is from a character basis. I don't think he has the character that that we ought to have in a president. But the majority of people disagreed, and I think I've also, and this is kind of a funny thing, and to the extent I haven't said this before, I didn't vote for Donald Trump in the presidential election, either in the primary or in the general. So, gosh, what else does Trump do that appalls me?
So I guess
on the political front, I guess what would most appall me from Trump would be things like the tariffs, which, again, my sense was this is terrible. Now, looking back on it, this may just be posturing, and maybe I'm less appalled as it plays out, because it seems like maybe he was just kind of kidding, and that was just Trump being Trump and trying to bring people to the table. Gosh, what else would Trump? You know, I think so many of the tweets are ridiculous and demeaning to the office of the presidency. I think he could use Twitter actually in a really positive way, and occasionally he does. But I think personal attacks on other folks, it just, again, demeans the office, demeans the presidency, and it actually is counterproductive, as I see this as a Republican, to accomplishing the kind of agenda that I'd like to see, which is stuff like deregulation and tax cuts and so forth. That was made so much all the more harder because of this dumb personal stuff that he got into. So
right, which is why, I mean, I've said the opposite way, that I'm almost kind of, in some ways, it's almost to the advantage of liberals that Donald Trump won over someone like a John Kasich or someone like that, because he does shoot himself in the foot so often, and that's good if you don't necessarily agree with a lot of Republican policy priorities. So all right, well, that does it for this week's this episode of our listener mailbag. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We do hope you like what you heard. And, of course, listener support, it's what keeps us going. We really do appreciate it. So if you can help us out, that would be great. You can go to politicsguys.com/support. That's a direct link. Or just go to politicsguys.com and click on the support thing in the main menu. You'll see there. Subscribing and sharing episodes really does help a lot as well. Word of mouth is definitely the best advertising for us, and leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes is a big help as well. If you want to get in touch with us, mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Facebook page. Great stuff every week. That's facebook.com/politicsguys page, and we're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.